Thus nature spake. The work was done. How soon my Lucy's race was run. She died and left to me this heath. At his calm and quiet scene, the memory of what has been and never more will be. Welcome to another episode of Sunday Morning Poetry. Today, we are going to cover the fourth of five Lucy poems by William Wordsworth. Now, in this poem, it is called 3 Years She Grew in Sun and Shower. We get more a sense of the broader perspective of Lucy as this literary figure, this imaginative psychological creation of Wordsworth and other literary writers that represents certain emotions and attempts that Wordsworth is trying to uncover in one of his projects to trace the associations we make in a state of excitement. In the first Lucy poem that we covered, I talked, and this was about 4 episodes ago, so if you go back and into the podcast and look toward some of the other ones, I think it's Sunday Morning Poetry number 4 or 3 that we did this, and when we started the Lucy poetry poems. And when we covered that, when we talked about it, the thing that I brought up was that there are a lot of poems that are, or several other poems by Wordsworth that are considered Lucy poems. One of the more famous ones is Surprised by Joy, which is an amazing poem. And one of the reasons I think that that poem in particular is thought to be a Lucy poem is its relation to this poem here, 3 Years She Grew in Sun and Shower, which is about the death of his 3-year-old daughter. And Surprised by Joy is well known to be about his daughter, or it's much more known biographically that one is about the death of his daughter. He wrote it shortly afterward. And so there is a relationship, in that poem where he's in the gist of that poem, Surprised by Joy, which I really recommend you read, and maybe we'll cover it at another time. But the gist of that poem is that this man, this father, is walking along and he sees something that surprises him, that it's so joyful. And then he turns to share that moment of joy with his daughter. And then it hits him and he remembers that she's dead. So, and there's this moment where he said, how could I have forgotten? How could I forget that she's, and there's this, he's always playing it with the idea of how our memory and reality works and where's the interplay between the two. So that poem, which does not reference Lucy, is considered a Lucy poem when I really don't think it is, because, I do think there's a moment when he's writing these 5 poems in Germany, and there's a lot going on in his mind. And he's also, even though he doesn't exactly group them together consciously, Wordsworth does not call these the Lucy poems. Other people after him do. But I think what you get in grouping them in the way that he does, and when you do that, is you get a kind of total experience of his view of death and how it affects the living people. Right? So we have, the last time we did Strange Fits of Passion I Have Known, and that was last week. And that one, a lover is going to Lucy. So Lucy is now a lover. She's a fully grown woman. She's not a daughter. And in that case, the lover goes, he goes to the cottage of this Lucy, and on his way, while he's on his horse, he sees the moon. He goes into this kind of sleep-like trance, which we're going to experience this a little bit on this podcast today with Keats, because I'm going to bring up a poem by Keats to compare this one with. And what happens is he goes into this kind of trance-like sleep, which we all go through oftentimes when we're driving and we don't know how we got to where we were. We forgot that, it just became automatized in our skill sets of actually maneuvering through the streets. And that's kind of the trance that he's in. And then in that trance, the moon is dropping and he's kind of dazed in it. And then the moon drops, the planet drops behind the cottage of his lover. And then all of a sudden, you know, from that emotional, from that, you know, vision, he gets a thought that maybe his lover has died. Or what it is to me that if Lucy should be dead. In the poem, I Traveled Among Unknown Men, which is another Lucy poem that we covered a couple of weeks ago. You know, in that one, he goes traveling or he goes abroad and he starts to realize that he loves England. And one of the reasons he loves England so much is because that's where his dead ex-lover or his dead lover lays. And she's a part of that. And so he combines and he associates the landscape of England to his lover who has now passed. And that's, again, him, as you know, this is why I'm saying taking these as a whole. And we'll cover these a little bit more in the next one. You know, we'll talk about She Dwelt Among Untrodden Ways, which was another one that we covered, which is, you know, this one is more about how we have this kind of loner Lucy who is out amongst the, you know, she's not well known to people, but she means something to him. And again, there's associations there. And then there's this one, 3 years she grew in sun and shower. Now, we also covered weeks ago, and if you haven't listened to those other podcasts, that's okay. I'm trying to give you kind of a synopsis to help give you a context for this particular poem and how they kind of fit together and why I do think it's beneficial to read the five Lucy poems together and kind of think about, you know, analyze them for yourselves, enjoy them. You know, they stand alone, but they also do kind of relate to one another in certain senses that can expand your consciousness and awareness of what Wordsworth is trying to say. So I also covered a couple of what were called the Matthew poems. This is opposed to the Lucy poems. And the Matthew poems is about, you know, it's basically about a school teacher. And there is a piece of wisdom, and the ones that I covered were Two April Mornings and The Fountain. And in these poems, there's a piece of wisdom that I think is very helpful in real life. And he says, Matthew, the old man, so Matthew's an old man talking to a younger man in these two, in both of these poems. So it has that kind of mentor-mentee relationship, teacher and student. And this old man, and they're always walking in the forest or somewhere, and there's a stream or there's something. And then out of nowhere, it seems, this old man just gets struck by a powerful emotion of melancholy, of sadness, of remembrance, which kind of baffles the younger person, which, you know, we talked about in those other ones, is a baffling moment for young people when they're just kind of enjoying the day. It's like, oh, la-di-da-di-da-di-da. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this old person is just like sad and remembering things about the past. It's like, oh, geez. Right? Like, and that's kind of the feeling that you sometimes get. But in that, we have this bit of wisdom that I've repeated over and over again. And I think, I hope you'll learn from it and understand what he's trying to say here is that the wiser mind mourns less for what age takes away than what is left behind. So remember, what age takes away are people, right? That's one of the things that it takes away. I mean, it also takes away strength, right? It takes away your mind sometimes, takes away your vitality. But it also takes away like loved ones, friends, parents, aunts, uncles, people that you know, knew years ago. It takes those. That's what happens is that they die and they're gone from you. But what's left behind, that's what you should mourn more of, is what's left. And that's interesting that he's talking about mourn. The wiser mind mourns less for what age takes away than what is left behind. So what's left behind? The emotions about that. Sometimes that's the joy too. So the joy, if you're a widow, what age leaves behind is the joys that you had. You still feel that, you know, read Surprised by Joy. And that's such an odd, guilty pleasure in a sense, right? That you feel this joy and then, but you can't, you know, you don't fully experience. It's like, it's a remnant from the past. And there is something, you know, important about that that's going to be, I think, helpful in all of these poems. Now, last time when I read Strange Fits of Passion, I said that the poem is a prime example of Wordsworth's attempt to trace the associations we make in a state of excitement. So all of these poems have that, but I think Strange Fits of Passion is probably the prime example of the of these poems that shows that. And then I brought up the issue of awe, which is that, you know, there is something deep within the internal world of humans, which is so immense, which is as immense as the cosmos. Keep in mind the Hugo quote, there is one thing grander than the sea, that is the sky. There is one thing grander than the sky, that is the interior of the human soul. And so this is the project of the Romantics. And, you know, oftentimes they might go too far in only thinking about the interior of the soul. But I think the great, great Romantics, and, you know, I'll be at, when you hear this, I'll probably be at a conference called OCON, Objectivist Conference, which is Ayn Rand, you know, by the Ayn Rand Institute. It's about Ayn Rand. And this is the 50th anniversary of the Romantic Manifesto. And one of the things that she says in the Romantic Manifesto about the Romantics is that they are not only interested in the internal world in a way that a lot of other authors and artists are not, but its relationship to the external world. So it's not just going inward in the stream of consciousness type of way, which you get later. But also, like, there is a relationship between the outer and the inner world, which you don't get as much before that. You know, you don't, when you read the Iliad and the Odyssey, you don't really get inner monologues and things about what Odysseus and Achilles is feeling. You get some of that, and it's only expressed in outward ways, almost like a stage play. And, you know, and even in something as psychologically deep as Shakespeare, you get these monologues, these alone, where they're just standing in front of the stage, the spotlight's on them, and they're kind of saying this inner monologue. But it's not the same thing as the 19th century, you know, in the 1800s and even starting in the 1700s when you're getting the novel, which really, you know, that's when the novel's really being born, and you're getting something like, you know, Robinson Crusoe, and you're getting this intense amount of inner world. And you're starting to see this more and more and more about the inner world. And you, this is something that is new, and it's part of the Age of Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, that people, you know, you have Newton and Copernicus, and you have all these people proving and talking about the cosmos, and, you know, Galileo, who's fighting this spiritual battle, as well as this, you know, saying that the sun does not revolve around the earth revolves around the sun. And, you know, they're proving these things mathematically, and they're making persuasive cases, and more people are believing that the, you know, that all that we've believed before wasn't real or wasn't true, and that there's this whole world out there, and it's massive, and we're just a small part of it, and there's these laws that govern everything. And then it starts to become clear that, well, maybe there, you know, there's laws outside of the universe, outside of ourselves, I should say. Maybe there's laws inside of ourselves. What laws are internal to us? And this is where you really get, I think, a lot of psychology starting to become more prevalent. And, you know, it's, you're going to get pretty soon a Dostoevsky who's really going to dive deep into a certain kind of psychology, and he's brilliant at it. And Wordsworth is doing the same thing. Wordsworth is interested in the love of man in relation to the love of nature. So he is the preeminent nature lover. In fact, the Lake District, which is where he's from, or where he lives, I think about 37 years of his 80 years of life or so. No, he died when he was 80. You know, I think 37 years, so almost half of his life is lived in the Lake District. And the Lake District is essentially copied in, you know, in the way that he talks about it and the way that he lives it in the Walden's Pond, which of course Thoreau talked about. And, you know, Thoreau's Walden's Pond is a, you know, throwback in a sense, or it's, you know, it comes a little bit after Lake District and all the things that Wordsworth is writing about. But the point is that, you know, there's this, the nature conservative movement in America is a direct response or direct spirit physicalization of Wordsworth's words. And, you know, so there's an interesting relationship between the two. And Wordsworth believed, and, you know, as we explore Wordsworth, we'll cover this more, but Wordsworth very much seemed to believe that the power of, or the love of nature is the love of man. And he wanted to kind of show that. Now, I think there are some things that he got wrong in his philosophy and his viewpoints, but at the same time, he did very much try to unite. He wanted to create this kind of natural religion, this secular religion, in contrast to what he had, you know, he was rebelling against. And remember, this is the time of the French Revolution. He participated in the French Revolution. You know, he wrote pamphlets for, he was a Republican, a staunch Republican. And, you know, so much interesting things. I'll stop there because, you know, he fell in love with Annette Vallon, who was a royalist. And they had a kid together. And then he had to flee and go home because they had, you know, France had a war with Britain and he was British. And it's like, it's very interesting. He had one of the most intense of all the romantics, you know, Keats and even Byron, who, you know, has this reputation of being mad, bad, and dangerous to know. And he goes and fights the Greek Revolution. And, you know, but I think in a sense, Wordsworth has, especially in his early years, one of the most dramatic of all of the biographies and all the lives of these individuals. He has the most experience in life in a certain sense. Anyway, you know, so the point is that he has, you know, a lot of intensity going on here. And there's this stress on the internal world. That's the whole point of this. There's this stress on the internal world that these authors have at this time. Now, this poem in particular that we're reading today is more about the idea, is about that idea of awe and what's going on. But the more intense focus here is that the love of nature leads to the love of man, or nature as our primary educator, a natural education. And now what he kind of meant about this, you know, is something that Rousseau would be in, or Rousseau says about this Emile, this child that's raised outside of the classical education of giving them all the texts and, you know, you have to beat them down with facts, which I sympathize with, even though I don't agree with them. I don't agree with Wordsworth or Rousseau, but I sympathize with the idea of, you know, beating kids over the heads with all these facts and not letting them be children at all, which I think is part of what they're reacting to. Okay, so let's do a reading of this, and then we're going to talk about Keats a bit. I want to try and, I don't know if I'll be able to read the whole thing. And, you know, then we'll talk about the whole poem. We're going to read Ode to Suquet a little bit, or some parts of it, because I want to contrast the language and the subject matter. I think it's revealing. And, you know, we'll also, with this one, I have the early version of 3 years, the one that's published in the 1802 Lyrical Ballads by Wordsworth. And then there's a revision, I believe, in 1815, which we'll read here, and we'll kind of discuss. There's some minor changes that I think are beneficial to read and understand. Okay, so let's see. All right, here we go. So 3 years she grew in sun and shower. Then nature said, a lovelier flower on earth was never sown. This child I to myself will take. She shall be mine, and I will make a lady of my own. Myself will to my darling be both law and impulse, and with me the girl in rock and plain, in earth and heaven, in glade and bower, shall feel an overseeing power to kindle or restrain. She shall be sportive as the fawn that wild with glee across the lawn or up the mountain springs, and hers shall be the breathing balm and hers the silence and the calm of mute and sensate things. The floating clouds their state shall lend to her, for her the willow bend, nor shall she fail to see, even in the motions of the storm, grace that shall mold the maiden's form by silent sympathy. The stars of midnight shall be dear to her, and she shall lean her ear in many a secret place, where rivulets dance their wayward round, and beauty born of murmuring sound shall pass into her face. And vital feelings of delight shall rear her form to stately height, her virgin bosom swell. Such thoughts to Lucy I will give, while she and I together live here in this happy dell. Thus nature spake. The work was done. How soon my Lucy's race was run. She died and left to me this heath, this calm and quiet scene, the memory of what has been and never more will be. Okay. So one important thing I should have mentioned before I started, I apologize, is just in terms of the structure of this poem, so it makes a little bit of sense, is, you know, it begins 3 years she grew in sun and shower, then nature set, and all that follows. So everything I was reading is actually a quote of from nature until he says, thus nature spake, which is the last stanza. So we have all the stanzas, I didn't count them, all the stanzas are really just the nature speaking. The first line and a half is the narrator, the father, saying 3 years she grew in sun and shower, and then nature said, a lovelier flower on earth was never sown. This child I to myself will take. She shall be mine, and I will make a lady of my own. So now we have nature kind of butting in here, in this case, to say that I'm, you know, this is the most lovely creature that I've ever seen, and I'm going to take her from you. You know, she doesn't, you know, there's an idea, of course, that some people don't, you know, that you don't belong to yourself, that your children don't belong to you. They belong to God, for instance. Well, Wordsworth doesn't say that they belong to a Christian God, but to nature. And he's personifying nature here. And the personified nature admires the girl so much, a lovelier flower on earth was never sown, that she belongs with nature. She doesn't belong with the father. Were the girl to have stayed with her father, she would be a lady of his household, right? But nature says, no, she will be a lady of my household, nature's household. That's the last line of this stanza, of this first stanza. She shall be mine and I will make a lady of my own. And this is important. I will make a lady. So we're talking about a baby. We're talking about an infant, a three-year-old. A very young child, and so we're going, this is about educating, becoming a lady. So how do you become a lady? I mean, obviously there's the biological element, but that's not enough. We're talking about the educational element, the education of a child, which is the core purpose of, I think, growth in terms of human beings, is education, is helping to become a man, or in this case, a woman, but the, you know, human, fully human. Now, here we have a difference in this next stanza. We have a difference between the original version, so let me pull this up here, and the version that I'm reading. So in the original version, it says this, let me read the second stanza of this original version. Her teacher I myself will be, she is my darling, and with me the girl in rock and plain, in earth and heaven, in glade and bower, shall feel an overseeing power to kindle or restrain. Now, if you're on Facebook or troubadourmag.com, you can see the video and where I'm looking at now. So here's the second version, the 1815 version. It starts, myself will to my darling be both law and impulse. And then it goes, and with me the girl in rock and plain, in earth and heaven. So he's making these comparisons. He's bringing these visuals here very powerfully. Rock, you know, this girl, your daughter, in rock and plain, in earth and heaven, in glade and bower. And there's that bower again, remember, a shady tree, shall feel an overseeing power to kindle or restrain. So there's, you know, he's making these comparisons between all these things. And he's saying that this girl's going to be one with these things. And I want you to look at the differences between these two first lines. And there's an important difference. And I think the second version is better here, in my opinion. And here's why. So in the first one, he says, you know, this is nature speaking. So nature says, her teacher, myself will be, she is my darling. In the second version, the poem goes, myself will to my darling be both law and impulse. Now think about the difference between teacher and the girl in the first poem. Her teacher, I myself will be. I will be her teacher. The word teacher is very important. That's what he's trying to change here. She is my darling. So, you know, darling as in loved one, you know, oh, darling, obviously we know what that means, but there's, you know, something important that nature is, you know, saying this about her. Now we have, so we have this idea of teacher and the girl that's changed from teacher to both law and impulse. And by changing it to law and impulse, so you have a more unification between nature and the girl. So when it's teacher, there is a semblance of nature is separated from the girl. So there's that separation going on that I think is a problem for Wordsworth, is that he doesn't want there to be any separation between nature and the girl. The girl is part of nature. She is one with nature. She has the same power to kindle or restrain, to start, you know, the clouds going and to start rain or to stop the rain. She has those types of powers to grow bowers, to make glades, to bring rocks and plains into existence. I mean, she has the power that nature has to bring all this beauty and things. And the, you know, we're going to look at the horror things that she can also bring. But I think by seeing the two differences, you know, both law and impulse, this is Newtonian terms. This is the terminology of Newton. And that, again, we're getting with the romantics are interested in how the world works, but internal to man. That's a very important part of what makes a romantic, is the internal part of man in relation to nature or the external world. And that she has the law and impulse that nature has as well. And we've learned this from, you know, the Galileos, the Copernicus's, the Newtons of the world have shown us the law and impulse that keeps the heavens in the heavens. Well, that's the same law and impulse in this girl and in people. Okay. In the second version, so the emphasis is on the relationship between nature and Lucy. Both are one. That's the whole point I'm trying to make. In the early version, Lucy is student and nature is teacher, but this is a separation between the two. By nature, by nature saying, myself will to my darling be both law and impulse, as with me, the girl, nature is saying there is no difference between Lucy and me. Okay, let's move on. So that's, I just wanted to synopsize, make sure that was clear. That's, I think, an important change that really helps you understand what Wordsworth is trying to convey. In the next stanza, she shall be sportive as the fawn that wild with glee across the lawn or up the mountain springs. And hers shall be the breathing balm, and hers the silence and the calm of mute insensate things. So fauns and nymphs and dryads, these are imaginative creatures going back to ancient Greek mythology that were representative of the natural world. And there's a story of Apollo and Daphne where Apollo is struck by Cupid's arrow because, you know, he was being very cocky to Cupid and said, I'm powerful with my spears, I can kill. And, you know, you're not powerful, you little baby boy. And Cupid hits him with his love arrow. And then he falls in love with Daphne, the son of a very powerful lake or a stream god, I think. And so, you know, in ancient Greek times, everything was kind of every natural thing in the world was a god. There was a sun god, a moon god, a stream god, a forest god. So there were gods all over the place, tons and tons of thousands of gods. And Daphne was the daughter of one. Apollo goes around, he chases her, he goes after her, because he's so emphatic with her and she rules his whole life. And, you know, it proves that Cupid is more powerful than this powerful warrior. Love is more powerful than fighting and war. And then she, you know, in resisting, begs her father, the stream god, to turn her into a tree. And he does. And then, of course, we get the first, you know, vision of tree huggers. Apollo hugs the trees in love with this tree. And it's kind of that idea of falling in love with nature. And he literally hugs the tree. And, you know, that's what fauns and nymphs and dryads and all those things are. And that's what Lucy is becoming. So she's not going to become a lady of the father's household, the human household. She's going to become one of the natural household, the household of nature. And like fauns of old, she shall be the voice of mute, insensate things. Rocks, trees, bowers, plains. These are mute. They don't talk. She talks for them. She represents them. And balm, by the way, is a fragrant ointment of or preparation used to heal or soothe the skin. So she actually becomes the healing, the natural medicinal thing. She is that thing now. Now that she's gone, she has that power to be, you know, to have that healing power over humans. Okay. So we'll do a little comparison to Keats in a second. So let's go to the next one. The next one is the floating clouds their state shall lend to her, for her the willow bend. Nor shall she fail to see, even in the motions of the storm, grace that shall mold the maiden's form by silent sympathy. So we have more powers that she's going to get in a sense. So there's more integrations of Lucy and nature. She floating clouds. So she's going to have the power of flight, right? In a sense, you know, the floating clouds, their state shall lend to her. So what is the state of floating clouds? Floating, right? But also calming, you know, they're just a beautiful part of nature. And, you know, if you know, I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud by Wordsworth, if you know that poem, which we'll cover in a future episode, I believe I covered it in an earlier version of the show. So if you go way back, you'll find it, but I'll do it again. The floating clouds, their state, this floating state and beauteous state shall lend to her the willow bend, right? So she bent, you know, she's one with nature and nature will do her will, nor shall she fail to see even in the motions of the storm grace that shall mold the maiden's form by silent sympathy. So even the horror of storms, the terror that storms can bring will be part of her. It will be like the dress that she wears. It's part of her now. So she's a part of all these things. Here's the next stanza. The stars of midnight shall be dear to her, and she shall lean her ear in many a secret place where rivulets dance their wayward round and beauty born of murmuring sound shall pass into her face. So she will be a sister to the stars. She will be everywhere, even in secret places where rivers, you know, go this way and that, wayward round. And all of these forces in nature shall pass into her. They become her. I mean, just imagine this, you know, if you know the image of Vitruvius, I'll try to pull it up here if you're watching. Vertumnus. I always get that wrong. Yes, Vertumnus. So, sorry, Vertumnus. If you're on Facebook, you could see Vertumnus. So there's like, it's this image of a god that represents nature. And, you know, so you have grapes in his hair and his nose is like a pear or something. It's, you know, every part of his face is all fruits. Every part of his body is fruits. He's got lettuce for shoulders and he's got flowers popping out of his shoulder or one of his shoulder trapezoids muscles. So you have that as kind of what's, it's all passing into her face, all of nature. And vital feelings of delight shall rear her form to stately height, her virgin bosom swell. Such thoughts to Lucy I will give while she and I together live here in this happy dell. And that's the end of the poem, that's the end of nature speaking. And vital feelings of delight shall, so she, nature is telling, the father that she's going to form into a stately height. She's going to grow into a woman, her virgin bosom swell, you know, and she, such thoughts to Lucy I will give while she and I together live. So all the thoughts that he's been talking about, nature will give to this woman. And, you know, that's the promise that nature gives to the father, since nature is taking Lucy from the father. Now the last stanza. Thus nature spake, the work was done. How soon my Lucy's race was run. She died and left to me this heath, this calm and quiet scene, the memory of what has been and never more will be. So remember, you know, a heath, by the way, is an area of open, uncultivated land. especially in Britain, which with characteristic vegetation of, you know, types of, you know, heather, I don't know, like coarse grasses, basically just think of a patch of vegetation land. And what is, you know, that's all that's left is, so he now, whenever this father looks out at this patch of land, he sees his daughter. He says, oh, there's a storm coming. That's my daughter. Oh, there's a bird flittering through the branches. That's my daughter. The rock and the plain. That's my daughter. The stars above. That's my daughter. And so there's a sense in that this is, you know, in religion, this is the equivalent of what we do in religious circles of telling the parents of grieving parents who have lost a child that their child is in another plane of existence, happy. Now, whether you agree with that or not, you know, it's a separate issue. That's just what's going on here, is that the father is kind of telling himself that this story of she's part of nature now. She's part of all these things. She's gone back to nature. And in that, she will grow as a font. And of course, it's all happening in his imagination. And I think he kind of realizes that, but there is a sense where he doesn't. There is a sense where he's literally thinking, you know, that her race is done, and he's saddened by this. So it's not like it really comforts him. This nature spoke, the work was done. How soon my Lucy's race was run. Right. And she died and left to me. Right. She leaves only this calm and quiet scene, the memory of what has been and never more will be. So he knows the joys of what he has, poem Surprised by Joy, and the pleasures of or the guilt and the sadness that comes with that. OK, now let's do a little comparison with with Keats here. Move my image over here. So let's do a little comparison with Keats to get an idea of some differences and I think some similarities between the two, or at least to help emphasize what Wordsworth is doing that's different than what Keats is doing. Now, I'm not going to read the whole poem. This is Ode to Psyche. I pronounce it Suke, although I don't think that's how Keats would have pronounced it, only because that's how the transliteration is technically from ancient Greek to English would be pronounced suke. At least that's how I was taught it in my philosophy of ancient Greek class in college. So that always stuck with me. But Ode to Psyche, Ode to Suke. Now, it begins. Now, I've covered this poem before. I'm a huge John Keats fan. And like John Keats, I'm a bigger fan of Wordsworth. I think Wordsworth is the greater poet in a lot of ways. But Keats is an amazing poet. Now he begins, O goddess, hear these tuneless numbers rung by sweet enforcement and remembrance dear, and pardon that thy secrets should be sung even into thine own soft conched ear. Surely I dreamt today, or did I see the winged Psyche and with awakened eyes? I wandered in a forest thoughtlessly, and on the sudden, fainting with surprise, saw two creatures couched side by side in deepest grass, beneath the whispering roof of leaves and trembling blossoms, where there ran a brooklet scarce espied. Mid hushed, cool-rooted flowers, fragrant-eyed, blue, silver-white, and budded Tyrian, they lay calm-breathing on the bedded grass, their arms embraced and their pinions too, their lips touched not, but had not bade adieu, as if disjoined by soft-handed slumber, and ready still past kisses to outnumber. At tender eye-dawn of Aurorian love, the winged boy I knew, but who is thou? Oh, happy, happy dove, his Psyche true. So I'll stop there for now. I wanted to kind of set up what's happening in this poem. Ode to Suke, this isn't I won't go into it. Look at the earlier version. We could talk about what an ode is, why it works the way it does, and the other podcast I did on this poem. It's not too long, but you probably noticed right at the beginning how much more complex the word choices are here. You know, even in the way that it's structured, oh goddess, hear these tuneless numbers. You know, and what does tuneless numbers mean? And you don't get stuff like that. You know, 3 years she grew in sun and shower. That's pretty straightforward. Right. I mean, it's not exactly how we would talk, but it's, you know, the Wordsworth language is much more straightforward and simple. That's his project. And Keats is a fan of that. And he does that in his own sense, but he also adds to it a lot more allusion. He's much more a fan of ancient Roman and Greek mythology. So there's allusions to Ovid and the Iliad and all these Greek myths. And you hear that a lot more. I mean, Psyche itself is a Roman myth. Right, the myth of Psyche that he's talking about is, and this poem is about this Roman myth that happened at the end of the myth-making world. So she is like the last of the goddesses he talks about. O latest born and loveliest vision far of all Olympus's faded hierarchy. So he's, you know, this is Keats writing in the 1818 or 18, you know, teens. And he's talking about this woman, this goddess who was never quite given her due. And then he says, O brightest, though too late for antique vows, too late for the fond believing lyre. So in ancient times, people, the Greeks and the Romans, would have actually believed this. They would have, you know, sung with all their hearts and, oh, you know, it's like Tinkerbell. If you just believe she exists, right? Clap and she'll come back to life. If you truly believe in her, she'll come into existence. That's kind of the feeling that he's conveying here. And then he says, I see and sing by my own eyes inspired to let me be thy choir and make a moan upon the midnight hours. He will be the priest. Yes, I will be your priest and build a fane, a temple in some untrodden region of my mind where branched thoughts new grown with pleasant pain instead of pines shall murmur in the wind. And why will he do it? And there shall be for thee all soft delight that shadowy thought can win, a bright torch and a casement ope at night to let the warm love in. He will be the love that she deserves, the priest that she deserves, and this will help him and others bring the warm love in. So some of the differences in Ode to Sukain and Keats in general from Wordsworth is Keats speaks to an already formed goddess. He laments that his poesy is insufficient in praising her. Oh, goddess, hear these tuneless numbers. So tuneless numbers are reference to his own poetry, his own song. They're tuneless. They don't have a tune. They're not sufficient. I've read it as critics have talked about it as a kind of false modesty. And I think there's something accurate there. I think he's not quite so modest as to say that, they're completely tuneless. But in a sense, I do think he's a little bit more modest. He's definitely more modest than Wordsworth. Wordsworth thinks of himself as this, you know, myth maker. Like he's, and all of his work added together is kind of like, oh, this is the new religion. Like, and I'm able to do this. And in fact, John Keats himself, again, an admirer of Wordsworth, said of Wordsworth that Wordsworth was the egotistical sublime. I mean, he wrote about his own inner psychology as well as, and said that applied to everybody. Now, you know, we could talk about that at some other point, but that's what Keats believed of Wordsworth. I agree with Keats in that. I think the term egotistical sublime is a very good term to use for Wordsworth. So in this poem, Ode to Psyche, he discusses how he dreamt, or perhaps it was reality. He's not sure. You know, he says, surely I dreamt today. Or did I see the winged Psyche with awakened eyes? You know, he's not sure. He's kind of in a dreamlike state. We saw this with strange fits of passion, but there's a much more emphasis on the dreamlike. You know, it's almost like a drug-induced state. Even the meter and the rhythm of this poem kind of makes you feel like that. And he does a throwback to Wordsworth, or likely a throwback to Wordsworth, when he says right after that, I wandered in a forest thoughtlessly. I wandered as lonely as a cloud. And you know, in that poem by Wordsworth, you get the sense that this poet is kind of just drifting along, and then he sees this, you know, field of daffodils that strike his mind. And in the same sense as the field of daffodils struck Wordsworth's mind, so in an even more heightened drug-like and trance, he sees these two mythical figures, and on the sudden, fainting with surprise, saw two fair creatures couched side by side. And then it looks like they're making love or something in deepest grass beneath the whispering roof of leaves and trembled blossoms, where there ran a brooklet, scarce espied. I could barely see it. So again, it's all this kind of misty language. We're not, do I really espy it? Scarce espied. Mid hushed, cool rooted flowers, fragrant eyed. I mean, again, we're getting language of like, you know, if you've ever done drugs that really affect your vision of the world, like acid or mushroom, it's like everything seems like a much deeper sense, or everything's quite different. Things move around in ways that they don't normally move. And that's kind of, you know, he's looking at these flowers, fragrant eyed. His eyes are misted over, blue, silver, white, and budded Tyrian. Now he's entering into Tyrian, Tyre, a famous river where you have this is where Dido from the Aeneid, you know, the queen of, I'm forgetting the land that she's this queen that Aeneas comes to for help. And, you know, this is also the birthplace of several different gods and goddesses. They calm breathing on the bedded grass, their arms embrace. These are the two figures, and their pinions too, their wings. So, you know, now he's starting to see more clearly what they are. And they're these these mythological creatures right before his eyes. Their lips touched not, but had not bade adieu. So he sees them, you know, right after the sexual act is what I'm taking from this, because the leaves are trembling. And then when he finally, you know, it's almost like he's going through a portal. If you've seen this on like television or movies, and you know, everything shimmers and he's kind of seeing the figures out there. And then he reaches the other side of the portal. Their lips touched not, but had not bade adieu. And then as if disjoined by soft-handed slumber and ready still past kisses to outnumber, a tender eye dawn, right? So his dawning of his eyes of Aurorian love. So it's this language of this misty language that is not present in Wordsworth very much. And there's a big difference because he says that since he has no temples, since she has no temple, Psyche, he will create one in the untrodden region of his mind. So Keats is saying that he will be priest to the underpraised goddess. Wordsworth is saying that Lucy will become that goddess. So that's a very big difference. Is Keats, his subject is this already formed goddess, and he's going to be, you know, a groveling priest. I mean, I'm kind of exaggerating with the groveling, but he will be a priest for her in his own mind. Where Wordsworth is interested in the actual development of these creatures. How does one become a goddess? And there's the story of Ariadne who, you know, helps Theseus get through the tunnel to the maze, to the Minotaur, so he could fight it and get back by giving him a piece of string. He leaves the string behind him. He kills the Minotaur and he comes back by the string. He tells Ariadne he's going to marry her and he doesn't. So she's stuck on that land. She mourns out, Theseus, thou hast not all her crew. And then, you know, all of a sudden Bacchus comes along, the god of wine and ecstasy, and falls in love with her and makes her, you know, they fall in love for a lifetime. And then when she dies, she becomes an immortal goddess, or, you know, she transcends into immortal goddessness. And so there are some stories about the births of mortals becoming gods. And that's what Wordsworth is interested in, as opposed to the Keatsian project, which is more just kind of beautiful praise, very wonderful, some of the greatest praise ever existing in the English language, you know, for these beautiful objects. The same thing with Ode on a Grecian Urn. So one is about, Keats is about the ecstasy one feels about that state of mind when contemplating beauty. Wordsworth is how the beauty is formed in our minds. It's the associations we make. Lucy is going to become a lady of nature, a goddess of sorts. Okay. the Romantics in general, the project of the early Romantics was stressing intense emotion. Imagination was intellect, was the intelligence, was the reason of man applied to that intense emotion. As Wordsworth put it, poetry is intense emotion recollected in tranquility. So what poetry is, what makes poetry poetry in his sense, is that you have this overpowering, overwhelming sense of an emotion. And you take that and you look at it like Newton looked at the cosmos. You know, just like the ancients would look at the cosmos and have only emotions and just pray and stomp their naked feet in the mud in the hopes of trying to get something out of this nature or you know, not piss off the nature at the very least. Wordsworth is saying, you know, something more along that the lines of what Newton and Galileo and all these great scientists have said, that no. There are laws and impulses. There is an order to it that we in our minds need to figure out. Your reason applies to the emotion. Put it into art through words. Now, there is a sense in the Romantics, and this is what they become known as, and one of the concepts, the key concept of Romantic thought, is this kind of estrangement between nature and man. And this is more present in other authors, but it's definitely present in Wordsworth for sure. And I think this is, it's probably very present, I should say, actually, where, you know, they're seeing the Industrial Revolution just happening, and they don't know that it's going to lead to today and all the amazing things and the life extension that we have today and the ability to go to the moon rather than just look at the moon and see it befell behind the cottage, or we can actually walk on the moon. And, you know, so they don't see all of that. They just see this smokestacks, you know, these buildings coming up, and they're starting to take men and women out of the nature, out of the farms, into these big cities, and turn them into like widget turners, where it's your job just to turn a widget. And they just keep carving more and more out of nature. And so they start to see like it's going to be, oh my gosh, there's this part of humanity that we don't understand that's misaligned with the natural world. It's just kind of carving over everything. Now, I think Rand would say, and I agree with Rand, that that's part of, you know, human beings' ability in their mind is to transform nature. But it's too early, you know, at this point for these high emotional people, and they don't have the right philosophy. So there is a feeling of estrangement that you get at this period. And it's, you know, not too much longer that we're going to get Marx, you know, in his whole view of the estrangement of man. And so in this poem, 3 years she grew in sun and shower, nature is saying, I'm going to make a girl who's integrated to nature properly, the way that man should be, the full integration of man in nature. And the father is comforted by the thought that his daughter will be, you know, educated by nature, more that she will be one with nature, and yet he is still grieving at the same time. So there's an excited emotion of grief over the loss of a beloved child, and there's associations with her spirit to nature. So we'll end with this. One of the major differences, I think, that I've come to in the between Wordsworth and Keats was, for Wordsworth, you know, Keats denies the complete efficacy of our senses. There is a part of him which wants this, you know, ephemeral world to be real. And he wants to put us in this state to get us to see this realness, you know, using this rhythm and meter and this, you know, this the way that everything sounds, you know, oh, brightest though, too late for antique vows, too late for the fond believing lyre, when holy were the haunted forest boughs, holy the air, the water, and the fire. And so there's this kind of way that this sounds, and it's like a chant that you would do in an ancient church. But his goal is not the elevation or the reliance on the way our five senses operate. So, you know, you have a sense of you see something in the world, it hits your senses, And through those perceptions, you integrate, you unify them via the imagination. And that's what the essence of romantics. And they all did this, I think, in different ways. And, you know, and I think Keats is a little bit more in terms of he's looking more at the fantastic element and kind of leaving some of the strength of the senses behind. That's not to say he's bad. I mean, if we were to look at Keats individually, he's amazing and he has amazing ways of looking at the world that I love. But Wordsworth is not just interested, he's not interested in how we think that things appear to us, but how they actually appear to our senses. And this is a major difference, I think. And here's a quote, we'll end with this, from Wordsworth. "The appropriate business of poetry, which nevertheless, if genuine, is as permanent as pure science. Her appropriate employment, her privilege, and her duty is to truth of things, not as they are, but as they appear. Not as they exist in themselves, but as they seem to exist to the senses and to the passions." Now, I think there's a lot of mixed philosophy there that's not good. I think he's wrong about certain things. I think there's certain elements here that leads to the problem that we have today. And, you know, you hear a lot of people argue that this, that one of the issues with secularism is that they, like Wordsworth, try to build their own religion, quote unquote, their own whole view of the universe, our place in the universe, society's place in the universe, versus let's just do the things that we've always done and believed in to some sense. And that's true that that's what Wordsworth is trying to do. He's trying to build from scratch, from the, he goes from the very start of our senses. And he says, this is, we're going to unify. Imagination is unification of these senses. That's how Coleridge and Wordsworth meant them. We're going to unify this into our own religion. Now he failed. Wordsworth could not finish this. His main project, The Recluse, which was supposed to be his version of Paradise Lost, of Dante, of Virgil's Aeneid, you know, of the Iliad and the Odyssey. It was supposed to be his version of that, encompassing all of his view of man, his man's relation to nature or the universe, and man's relation to man. It was supposed to encompass all of that. It didn't. He couldn't do it. And I think part of it is because he had the wrong view of reason, which I think is somewhat present here. Now, I'm not a philosopher of epistemology, but Wordsworth was kind of a epistemological person. Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that, and you know, we'll talk more about that next time. Stick around next week, share this video if you liked it, or go to the podcast at, you could find it on Spotify, on iTunes. It's Troubadour just Troubadour Podcast, or go to troubadourmag.com and find the links there. So thank you, and I'll see you next time.